Hello again. Welcome to the Doomer Optimism podcast. Today we have a longtime presence on Doomer Optimism, Nathan Gates, who's going to be co-hosting with me. And we have Drake, who caught our attention because he talks a lot about silvopasture, and we'll define what that is. But it's a very, I think, interesting, useful, innovative form of agriculture. And Nate, I think you're a great co-host because you have some experience with grazing cows, and you're also planting a bunch of trees, and so it seems like you're kind of moving in this direction. And so do you want to start us off, Nate, by just briefly introducing yourself? Most people probably already know you, and a little bit about your operation and where you're trying to go with it.
Sure, thanks. Yep, I'm Nate, and I as Jason mentioned, I have a livestock farm, cattle specifically. We're growing a herd, and you know, I'm pretty new at it. It's 5 years now, but I know a lot more than I did when I started. And you know, silvopasture is really of the utmost interest to me for a number of reasons. You know, kind of at first, like a lot of this, it's theoretically interesting. Like it's like, oh, trees are neat and draws down carbon and you know, all these things that are kind of like theoretically very cool. But what really, now that I've been doing this 5 years, is extremely interesting is when you have silvopasture, you have shade for your animals, which is great. And also in any pasture that I have right now, and we have quite a bit and just got a lot more just to due to the reworking of a lease, everywhere, the best grass is always partial shade. The stuff that the cows love is in partial shade. The stuff that's in the sun is, you know, kind of scorched and stunted and doesn't grow as well if it's 100% sun. But around here, they're, you know, the trees help hold moisture in, and the grass stays tender longer. And so from just a practical perspective of feeding cows, I can see with my eyes, like, oh man, this is better. You want partial shade. You want trees sprinkled throughout. This is like much better for the animals. So there's, I think, a ton of like theoretical reasons why, and not that those aren't real, right? But they're just not as tangible as what I can see when I have the cow. So yeah, I'm really excited, to have this conversation and dig more into silvopasture, because while I'm starting to learn about it, you know, there's a whole hell of a lot more I don't know.
Yeah. Nice. All right. So Drake, why don't you, this is your first time on the podcast, why don't you introduce yourself for the audience, formative experiences, and we'll describe what silvopasture is and its attributes later, but this, and maybe you'll need to describe a little bit of it about why you got into it, but what led you to kind of like your lifestyle today and what you're trying to do on this piece of land that you have?
Oh, great. Thanks for having me. Yeah. I'm Drake Larson. And right now I find myself on a place we call Three Ridges Ecological Farm, which is in Southwest Ontario, just a few miles inland from the north shore of Lake Erie. But I was born and raised in Iowa, and we just came here to this place into Canada. This is our ninth summer. I think a lot of the lessons I've learned here are applicable, you know, across the whole North American temperate zone. So don't let Canada dissuade you in thinking it's not applicable. And so in Iowa, I grew up, you know, right in the heart of sort of the industrial ag matrix.
Where in Iowa?
I grew up in a little town called Polk City, but then I spent, before we moved here, we were in Ames, the home of Iowa State University, for a dozen years. My wife's a soil ecologist. She got her PhD there. I got my undergrad and master's at Iowa State. So that was our last sort of home base. But growing up, I was right in the matrix of ag and, you know, in many ways, super proud of it and proud of Iowa corn-fed beef and Iowa chops and all these things, right? And then, but I was very much always on the land as a naturalist and a hunter. And then that took me into sort of my first, well, not my first, but as an adult, one of my first entrepreneurial adventures was being a hunting guide, sort of in Iowa, and then scattered across the Corn Belt quite a bit. And that was really like a full immersion into like what it was like to live all the time. And right, this, and some of these places are actually quite desolate when you're out in them. And like, I would argue I've spent more time in cornfields than probably any farmer. I've certainly walked farther in them and, you know, taken more naps right in the center of a cornfield than any farmer I know. And so anyhow, I had this interesting perspective, and that naturalist perspective and critique started to become formalized when I got involved in a research initiative based around goose biology. That took me into academics. And then in academics, I really, as an ecologist, sort of had a lot of these pieces come together for me. You know, I sort of went into academics as a, you know, conservationist, biologist sort of person, and then emerged after getting my undergraduate degree in ecology and a master's in sustainable ag, sort of emerged more interested in sustainable agriculture. And just the last few years of my master's and stuff was quite informative, in that we just there was lots of opportunity to travel. So I got to go to just every kind of different farm. And that actually led into some work where I spent a lot of time doing management plans for farmers and talking to a lot of farmers, and like all just this progression, which right now, you know, I'm skipping over like 12 years of time, but like this progression suddenly became like a passion to get on the ground and do my own thing. Not only because sort of my education, you'd use scientific terms like novel ecosystems and, you know, to describe these places and both industrial ag landscapes, but also alternatives. And it's like, oh, it's an interesting lens to think of novel ecosystems. But then also, the more I knew about agriculture, the more I was sort of like, took that doomer side of things, like, holy, I don't know if you can cuss on the podcast, but oh man, like our systems are really fragile. And I think being in a place and having a pretty good sense of your own food security might be very important, like in short order, right? So with sort of all this change, you know, from to suddenly being like, okay, get on some land. And so that's how we ended up here in Canada. It was really just a sense of, you know, you sort of take the cards that you're dealt and leverage it the best you can. And like, we looked all across Iowa and the Midwest, and but my wife is Canadian, so we had ties that brought us here. And then, so yeah, here I am on 50 acres now since 2015. And it's a, you know, 30 that they would call sort of arable land that has like a legacy of row crops and other things. We're in a very diverse area for agriculture. So fields have seen lots of things, tobacco and cucumbers and squash, but also corn and beans, continuous beans. They do. It's pretty intense around here. And 50 acres total, with 20 acres bush and 30 acres of arable. And then we've just been on a mission to just get it sort of seeded down and turn it into a resilient homestead, right, that we think can produce food for our community, but also bring us a lot of independence and security. And then also just a lot of what we're doing here, since I come from that academic lens, is sort of like just trying out new things, right? I don't necessarily think that I have like the answer to anything here, but I think agriculture is in a place where we really need to rethink everything needs to be rethought. And so how are we going to do that except for sort of seeing novel ideas? And, you know, in my master's work, which I won't go into because that's a boring past life, but I talked a lot to people about like their perspectives on landscapes and, you know, people want to be on perennial landscapes. There's both because there's like inherent beauty, and which I think is an important part of living a good life, but then also because just there's underlying intuitions and such, I think, in our humanity that say like, this place is more resilient than sort of an annual landscape that doesn't provide for your needs for a lot of part of the year. So here I am, we're trying out silvopasture. You know, I'm passionate about that. I think, you know, and maybe one step sort of above in the hierarchy is this idea of agroforestry. Just how can we be integrating trees and perennials into our systems? And yeah, I think think that's a good enough introduction to
yeah
tell you where I come from.
So just real quick, so is silvopasture, would you consider it kind of a subset of agroforestry?
Yeah. Okay. I would, you know, it's with silvopasture just being sort of the integration of grazing and tree production.
Yeah.
And then agroforestry, like that same template, and we could talk here a lot of what I have done and the way I think is like establishing an ecological template for the land with respect to sort of a hierarchy, which starts largely with water, but then things like fencing and access. But so I could take my system largely as set up now as silvopasture, and we could till the land in between and begin alley cropping, and then suddenly it would be, you know, an alley cropping system under sort of an agroforestry idea. And I do see some of our land will probably swing back and forth. But
right. Okay. And what would there be? I mean, so like the idea behind like lay cropping is you have animals in a place for a while, they fertilize the land, then you grow some crops, and then you could bring back animals. And so you're thinking that this could kind of switch back and forth.
Yeah, I think there's a place for that. And I, you know, for many different reasons, like, you know, Mark Shepard as a model for this sort of thing, if that's a name that rings a bell, with the New Forest Farm in Wisconsin, you know, that's how he started his system, because that was how he could do it economically, was growing these vegetable crops, squash and asparagus and stuff in between the rows. But then his system, you know, is now, I believe, largely seeded down either for hay or for grazing. So I think there's economic reasons to do it. I think on my own place, there are places that, so we came, the context being that, I'll just step back. It's, the context of this place is it was row cropped until 2008, and then it was purchased and someone built a homestead here and seeded it down and tried to do some hay and horse pasturing for 7 years until we moved here. But they didn't do a great job of it. And so I came with a grass base that's, some of it just pretty crappy, poor selection of forages. And so those places, you know, it may behoove them. Like if I tilled them up and grew crops there a few years, I could seed it down with a much better mix. And I argue with myself daily that I probably some of those places I should have just tilled them up and seeded them down with a new forage mix right away. And if not right away, then I should have done that after I had some earthworks in place, which have broken up all the slope lengths, which we can talk about too. So yeah, I think it would behoove the land to go back and forth. And, you know, certainly I think that's a way that we would, that's a way that we could probably get away from a lot of inputs in vegetable crops, is if we had these, you know, animals and green manures, and then we till up this fresh dirt. I mean, even all the row crop guys know, like if you till up a prairie and you have corn the next year, that's going to be the best crop of corn you ever had.
Nice. Nate, do you have any? How many questions?
Oh yeah, so many. It's fine. I had no idea I was gonna, you know, be chatting with a fellow Midwesterner either. Yeah,
and Tool fan.
All right. See, look at this. Here we go. yeah, this is gonna be fun. So, you know, I'm gonna say not too much, but just to kind of bring it into the discussion so that we can kind of reference it back and forth, I'll say just a little bit more actually about my place, because that, you know, kind of like what we're aspiring to, because it's an old family farm in West Central Illinois. So that was, we've been here a decade now. One thing you said that jumped out at me was, you know, I should have just that. And it's like, man, if I had known then what I know now, it's like, you can just start and save yourself so much, so many mistakes, but you just have to start somewhere, right? We ended up here, you know, we ended up here because it's, you know, sesquicentennial family farm, and we just had this opportunity. So we came, and it's 300 acres. So it's pretty sizable.
Amazing.
Which is awesome. And also just unbelievable amounts of work and management. And I don't manage at all. You know, cash rent the row crop, which is about 200 acres of it now, and that's done organically, which is sort of like a in between thing. You know, it's not maybe ultimately where we want to go, but it's a step in the right direction. So aspirationally, and maybe in the next few years, I'm hoping I will. I want to do a giant, like a giant alley cropping system with that. I want to do chestnuts and then alleys for all of the row crops. That's the aspiration there, and then. And that would probably be mostly, you know, like grain crop in between for a number of years. And then maybe over time, like we're talking about this back and forth thing, shifting over to being more great when the trees get bigger, doing grazing, doing, you know, haying, stuff like that. And then coming, you know, and maybe tilling it up now. I don't know exactly, but mm-hmm. It kind of like it's all cropland now. So it's like it's, you know, prime Midwestern farmland, too. Like it's good stuff. And then we have about 120 acres that's sloping and stuff. So when I think about silvopasture on that, that's always going to be silvopasture because it's never going to be suitable for tillage. So it's going to be, you know, trees in the pasture. So pure silvopasture is where we want to go. And right now what I do with that mostly is I let black locusts creep in and I mow off some of them and let some of them go now and again. So they're spaced out nicely. And that works pretty well because black locusts are great trees and grow really fast. So, So I've gotten a couple larger pastures well on the way to silvopasture just by sort of selectively mowing and leaving stuff. So that's kind of what, you know, to bring into context what I'm trying to do here and sort of the longer term vision. Tell me more about like specifically. Because I'm interested in getting in the weeds as much as possible or in the trees, whatever we want to say here, like mm-hmm. specifically you're doing around silvopasture and trying to establish it.
Okay. You know, I think to start that, the best place to start first is the idea, and we don't have to get in the weeds on it. And there can be other terms and there's different versions, but essentially like the universal term or well-known is like key line design. Mm-hmm. In terms of it, is that familiar to you? Or like even Mark Shepard's work of Water for Every Farm, I know he's changed it.
It's changed familiar to me, the term, and I've tried to like figure out what it is exactly, but I don't think I'm smart enough to understand it. It's like, I just don't get it.
Yeah, okay. The thought is that like given this topography of a land, there are essentially places in the landscape where water begins to concentrate and has potential for erosive power, you know, it begins a concentrated flow. And you can see, you know, if you look at a bare row crop field in the majority of the time, see, you know, 6 months of the year, 7 months when it's bare, you could see these flow patterns, right? Where it's like the dendritic pattern of water coming together and it eventually hits these places and channels amalgamate and then you become erosive flow. Well, the flip side of that pattern is that if there are inflection points where if you were to grab that water and not let it gather in an erosive sense, but rather interrupt it such that you can move it across the landscape at very low grades, slightly downhill, like at 1-2%, that you can interrupt that water ever getting that erosive power, or at least when it does gain the volume to have that power, it's going at a very slight slope. And so you can essentially move that water across the landscape in a non-erosive fashion, which both allows you to keep it and, you know, maybe move it into a pond or such if you'd like to, but at the very least slow it and spread it across the landscape, versus having it form in that valley. And so the idea of key line comes from the, in that valley, people like to describe it's like an inflection point where the hill goes from concave to convex or such. But to me, that all gets complicated because every piece of land is different. But however your topography lays, if there's this place where the erosive power starts, there's a place where you can capture. There's like an inflection point where it goes from, you know, happy water to hungry water sort of thing. That's the key point. And if you are to draw a contour out from that, a contour line out from that point, that becomes your key line. And that is simply like an elevation in the landscape that you sort of plan everything else off of. You know, and you may do some earthworks, you may do some tillage on that key line pattern, but you really can't see it. Or you may do things like I've built swales and terraces on that key line pattern and they become very visible things on the landscape. But as you lay out the key line pattern, one thing that happens is, so you're taking care of water and you're now doing like the, you know, the permaculture thing of slow it and sink it and spread it. But then that now sort of dictates all the flow patterns on your, on your farm. And as you lay this out and you lay different fence lines or tree lines or plow patterns up and down from the key line, you actually can get a flow to where like all your movement on the landscape, like with machinery, is at a very low grade. So oftentimes in like an undulating landscape, a lot of the work ends up just like happening straight up and down the hill or moving, just because the nature of the land almost dictates, if you're just driving your big tractor, that's where to go, is straight down the hill. But once you take this key line in, it sort of creates a flow, and then that becomes like essentially, you know, two sides of every one of my paddocks is a key line tree line. So I've taken these lines. Is the wind okay? It feels like it's picking up. Can you still hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you fine.
Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that made sense in sort of flow, but it's, we're just,
yeah.
The first thing I get, what I like about it, and it takes, I mentioned this idea of an ecological template before, is no matter what the farm's going to be, whether it's going to be strictly row crops, and especially nowadays with people doing these things like deep vertical tillage, they could really benefit themselves by doing it on a more logical pattern than just like pulling in the farm gate and starting there back and forth square. You could move water in tremendous ways and benefit your farm greatly by switching the pattern of things like deep vertical tillage to a key line pattern. But once you have that pattern, essentially you can lay out the whole farm and the flow paths, and fences or tree lines. And then you decide what you're going to grow, right? So you have this, you get the pattern in place, that first takes care of your water. And then like the sort of the products that you want to do come after that. Right. And so then I've got this pattern on the land, and then now that's where I start plugging in my trees and deciding what to grow, in different places. I forget where the original question started, but I wanted to get the idea of that template first.
Yeah. And I was mostly asking just about like putting silvo pasture, putting this into practice. And I kind of want to summarize too, just to sort of put it in different words and just to kind of emphasize it, because obviously this is really important. But if you think about water, I mean, like if you think, let's take a step back and just think about how water flows over a landscape, you know, it all concentrates, you know, like all the tributaries come together to form a main stem. I mean, it's just how water always concentrates together as it goes downhill. And what you're talking about essentially is, instead of letting it concentrate, you're interfering with it to diffuse it. Yeah, so like its natural tendency to flow down and concentrate, you are interfering with that on purpose using swales and different forms of earthwork. So when that water hits and tries to go where it wants to go and to cut that groove and to join with other water, you're putting a barrier there and forcing it in different directions. Was that a good summary?
Yep. The only thing I would change in the description is it's almost a little softer. So you could put that there and have this idea of barrier and stopping the force, which is the way a lot of like terracing was done. Or you can move slightly uphill and it becomes much softer and you're just sort of intercepting and redirecting.
Yeah.
The same thing. I'm only just picking that on that to like have this nuance of like, it can be this once water has that force, you cannot stop it.
I appreciate that too, because I think so much when we talk about agriculture, and especially if you talk about agriculture as it has been done, the language is very harsh and very controlling and very much like, well, we're going to make it do this and make it do that. And I think that nuance you're adding in is really important, because it suggests that we're not making it do anything. What we're trying to do is guide it and interact with it. So we are trying to shape it. We are trying to make it do more what we want than what its natural tendency is. But if we think we're going to just like force it into something, you know, we're working against it. We want to, you know, kind of allow it to do what it wants to do, but in our way.
And I like it as a metaphor too, for all of sort of life and farm management of just, if we just moved up the hill a little bit, our life could be so much easier and we wouldn't have these forces pounding up down on us.
Yeah. And so then once you redirect the water,
right? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you have essentially plantings, trees, things like that, that's, that that can use the water and keep it in place, you know, like that, you know, like so that water isn't just diffusing and then running back down, it's diffusing and then, you know, fueling or feeding the trees, feeding whatever plantings you have. So you're both redirecting it and then using it more effectively.
Yep. And feeding the deeper earth system too. So, you know, most farms lose a lot of water from, and I don't mean to stereotype, a lot of farms lose a lot of water through surface runoff and then lose a lot of water through tile drainage. And like
around here, when you drive, and you know this, right? Like when I drive after a big rain, the water flowing off of the fields is black. It's black. Full. It's flowing. It's like that. Oh my God.
Yeah. Well, and not the thing too, when you thought the thing too about those landscapes is there's a faction of soil physics where you can actually think of soil as a liquid too. And so there is this water moving on the surface that we see, but at the, in a geological sense, all that soil is moving the same direction too. You know, which just tells you like, oh, we better be doing a lot to put some organic matter on our hilltops because it's all moving, even under the best farm practices. You know, now the best farm practices, it's 100,000 years it's moving down the slope, but some of those bare fields, especially when it's frozen underneath, their soil subtly shifting. So, you know,
gravity's a bitch.
Yeah. Have you heard of like the old glass frames, like in Gothic era buildings, they have the original glass, and then the glass is like super thin at the top and really thick at the bottom because the glass for 200, 400 years, I don't know, whatever it's been, is actually flowing and starting to pool at the bottom.
Wow.
It's exactly the same thing with soil. And especially when there's no roots to hold it in place. So a lot of movement, and we need to stop that, right? Like,
so I'm curious about how you, after you kind of, you know, the permaculture principle, design from patterns to details, you're getting the pattern right with the water flow, and then you're figuring out where do you put your trees. Can you describe a little bit more about how you determine? Because, you know, there's, in more kind of conventional tree cropping, you have like, oh, should it be north, south, east, west? You know, there's some differences of opinion there. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like what you're saying is that the tree plantings will be all different directions depending on like where it, say, aligns along the swale or something, or, you know, like where, like how the water is flowing. Can you describe that a little more?
Yep. It does violate some of those things with respect to the, to north, south, east, west, but you could take some of those things into account. So I essentially have two kind of key lines on my farm, the way my topography is split from a high field and low field. And up top, here where the homestead is, it's essentially just bends around a big hillside. So it's, you know, it's a C shape or like a hockey stick. And those are stacked. And then so we basically do start with kind of north, south, and end with east, west orientation as it curves around the hill. In my bottom field, most of it is flat, but it comes out of a woodland on a slope. And then so my swale is just sort of like a squiggly line that is generally east-west. But, you know, within that, there's sort of different angles. And so that it does violate those things. There's other places on the farm. Like I'm just getting ready to set up a system that mimics something coming out of Minnesota, like the tree-raised poultry. I don't know if you've come across that, where they're like intensely growing trees, and that I have a 2-acre paddock. It's fully flat, and I'm sort of on the fence onto which, you know, I have more freedom for sort of orientation of trees. So I'll definitely take that into account in that spot. But you know, you can't account for it. Like another aspect that comes in, especially since we're always working on hills, is, you know, in some places, like most of my field up top is a north facing slope. And then another half or another portion is there's a valley, and then there's a south facing slope. And so like on that south facing slope, you know, I could put my trees closer together because they're capturing a lot more light. There's more topography, and that south exposure means I can really stack them in there. We're on the north. those high trees are eventually going to shadow, have quite a long shadow going downhill to the north. At the same time, I haven't got it all figured out, so I'm just
So I'm curious, and Nate, you kind of are already hinting at some things, but you know, what are the synergies that come about with, you know, when thinking about Silvo and thinking about pasture, right? So, you know, obviously trees, you know, perhaps they could improve pasture land. Maybe they also block out some light if you plant them too densely. Obviously, I can think of the animals can benefit from some of the tree crops at certain times of years. They benefit from the shade. But what are, you know, what is kind of like the high level, you know, like what is, what kind of magic happens when you put animals and trees together? Why is this kind of such a, you know, such a, I guess, progressive in an ecological sense form of agriculture?
Yeah. Does that go to me first, or Nate? Do you have thoughts on that?
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead. Okay. Again.
You know, I think first off, one of the sort of, again, my academic lens coming in, I worked on a paper once on biofuels, and we sort of classified sort of all types of agriculture systems on an axis of high and low diversity and high and low inputs. And that just has got me thinking about the benefits, and especially as we, you know, may or may not come up against resource constraints, or at least like resource distribution constraints, being on that low input system is a very resilient place to be. And you know, on the opposite end, we even saw during a little bit in COVID, right? Like just little fuel spikes and stuff really just wreak havoc, fuel price spikes wreak havoc in agriculture because they're so input dependent.
And just real quick for the audience, by inputs, we mean things like diesel fuel, we mean fertilizers, we mean what else?
Yes. To some extent, labor, you know, in that the labor can be offset. But yeah, fertilizers, fertilizers, the insecticides and pesticides, tillage.
Fungicides, you name it.
Yes.
And it's really, I mean, when you're in the farm belt, you can just see too, like, you know, typically, you know, in a July afternoon, I'm likely to see a bunch of crop dusters, airplanes zooming around my house, you know, just their crop dust and everything. So, which is amazing to think about. It's like warfare, you know, like you have these giant tanks rolling over the ground and you got airplanes dive bombing. Like it's really wild. But yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. And so this contrast of high input and low input systems, and then really the, you know, there's not really a lot of low input. You could have low input, low diversity systems, but you're not getting the progression to the productivity. So in terms of productive systems, you know, low inputs and high biodiversity is really a way to get away from the inputs. And then so that means it almost immediately means the integration of crops and livestock to me, which I think is another really important thing of what we need in the agriculture more, like the separation of crops and livestock has been a huge, huge problem. And then another theme that I guess sort of that pushes that into me is just like the idea of resilience. And so the fact that, you know, lower inputs also means sort of like lower sunk costs in a lot of decision-making. And so there's more adaptivity. You can be more adaptive. Like I could choose to buy an input because I'm low inputs and my sort of budget allows for that. Whereas like in the conventional system, if you've already done four passes of herbicide and two passes of insecticide, and then you know, comes to be August, like you almost can't refuse the fungicide because you've got so much sort of sunk. You're down this like input decision making. And so the flexibility of being low input is nice. And I think it lends itself to silvopasture. And then, you know, there's the climate change side of things, which I, you know, I very much think is like way myopic on carbon. We don't have to go there, or we can. But at the same time, in through the lens of carbon, which is what's getting a lot of, you know, excitement around it, is like silvopasture is like a nice earth healing ag modality through that lens. And so it's going to get lots of support. And on the same time, while I don't believe the sort of cult of carbon narrative, and I've been through it, right? I was an academic. It's taken me sort of like, there's been a lot of personal healing in my journey, which has allowed me to cut through some of the rhetoric that helps me think about these systems now. But I think there is, I think Earth is in peril and is in high need of some attention and healing. And then, so I think these, you know, silvopasture outside of the carbon lens is still a very Earth healing modality, which I appreciate, partially because we're taking care of that water. Maybe that may be the primary thing. Like, you know, water is a sacred thing. There are certain religions that believe that like 50% of God is distributed through the water, and yet it's this thing that we abuse so heavily. And so, you know, I believe it's a way for Earth healing. As I've become more interested in agriculture, like there's an impetus to produce for the community. Meaning, you know, I'm not really interested in like buying all the land I can and just making a game preserve or, you know, some like, I believe we're sort of divinely mandated to produce and provide for our neighbors in this way. And like, you know, I have most of my friends since I've come to this new community really do largely revolve around food and the people that I'm producing food for. And then also it's a really resilient strategy such that we talk about low inputs, and some of my farm enterprises are more input heavy, like broiler chickens or hog production. But I could very easily take this template and back it off and feed five families for free, right? With hardly any work, just moving a few livestock. And so can be ramped up into production, but there's also this like second tier of resiliency here where because we have trees of all different kinds producing food and fodder and fruits and firewood, you know, sort of have started to, the trees help us check off a lot of the spaces. And then I guess just to close it off with that idea of Earth healing, like I do believe a big part of what we've messed up in our systems, and there's really acute examples like Australia, so we've just deforested them, right? And it's like indigenous knowledge systems that talk about things like the trees draw the water into the center of the continent. And then, you know, some of biology can back that up with respect to how trees are putting off volatile organic compounds that actually are the nuclei that a raindrop can form around. And otherwise, without that nuclei, the rain just basically turns into a hazy mist and never falls. So whether it's this spirituality of the trees calling it in, or whether it's this strict biology of volatile organic nuclei, like it's very important. And if we want to sort of restore or at least maintain, you know, we're in a period of very great weather and climate for our world. And we know enough now, we could probably hold it here for our benefit, or we can let it oscillate in chaotic ways that nature does. And so I think it would behoove us to try to manage the Earth as a system with this more stable climate. And we know how to do it. And it's not cloud seeding. It's nothing else than just living in a, you know, synergies with the land at all scales, from your backyard farm plot to sort of global.
Yeah, that's, you know, when you talk about the trees, like I was referencing earlier too, it's, we had a terrible drought this year. And, you know, as I said, you know, like it's around trees where the grass grows best. And there was times during this drought where, you know, everything looked parched, but in the early morning I could walk under trees and there'd still be a little bit of dew. So it, you know, it just, it hugs the moisture to them. It's amazing. I'm curious. And you said, oh, well, we don't have to get into this, but we could, but kind of, those are the kind of things I like to get into sometimes, you know. Yeah. How talk, if you don't mind, about how you see the carbon myopia. I mean, is carbon dioxide a complete red herring? Is it not important at all? Is it a lack of focus? Like, how does it interact with what you're saying?
It's not a red herring, I don't think. I think a lot of it started from earnest concern. But I think it's a miss, like the analogy is Western medicine, right? And carbon, even though now it's debatable if we even need to hold, you know, what these numbers really mean. But I think at best, carbon is like a fever. And so we're noticing this thing, and, you know, a doctor will give a doctor will give a pill to sort of bring down the fever, but in real medicine, that means, like, first off, you haven't done anything with the actual, you've only treated a symptom, you haven't treated the disease. And then, you know, when you get into holistic medicine, you've knocked down the fever that probably actually was going to help the body to clear the disease. And so, like, there's no place in these systems to be sort of trying to mask symptoms. I think that's ridiculous. And then I think it's just, you know, whatever the term, I love it. I've only been back to Twitter for a little while after a long hiatus. But like this idea of spreadsheet brain, right? I think carbon gets focused on because it models nicely. If we really look at the global models, and don't like hold me to these numbers, but like even the IPCC models, and like, and I've worked with two in my past ecological history, I worked with two Nobel laureates that were on those committees, and I've had these talks with them, and not these specific talks because my thoughts are always evolving, but you know, anyhow, I'm just saying I'm not coming to this from a place of complete naivety, but like, you know, carbon models, or carbon is only 4 to 15% of the climate equation, and water is like 75 to 90%. But water is very complicated. Carbon models vary linearly, probably because it's a symptom, like the fever, and not the driver. Models linearly, we can extrapolate forever. Whereas water, we don't even know how many phases it comes in. You know, it used to say it was complicated because it comes in three phases. And now I think there's a person that says, or a group that thinks that there's four phases of water. And in between these phase changes, there's these latent heats of fusion and fission where, like, depending on which way it's going, cold and hot, you know, water's either absorbing or releasing a lot of energy. So it can be an energy sink, a heat sink, an energy source, a heat source. It's moved, you know, there's these complications of the, like I said, tree nuclei. So like, you know, 95% relative humidity moving across a continent doesn't tell you if it's going to rain or not, because it doesn't capture all the aspects of what makes things rain. And so I think we've just, it's just spreadsheet brain. And, you know, carbon's cool. You can do it. You can do the whole carbon model for the whole, you know, world in 15 Excel columns, and you know, have Excel kick it out. And water's this complicated thing we can't figure out, you know. And there's
a nice article when they, you know, so like water vapor is considered a greenhouse gas. Is that an effort to model it, or is that just something totally different?
I think people definitely think about it, but it's so hard to model, and all these models, like, you know, it's they're all based on so many assumptions. Like, yeah. Models are very useful in the scientific world. And so it's not like that models are wrong. I mean, even the wrong ones are sometimes very useful, but we just take too much of it, right? Like, somebody will figure something out and then we just treat it like gospel forever. Like,
yeah.
Not related to this, but like an example is, I was just looking at industrial ag fertilizer recommendations through universities, and like, what, you know, University of Minnesota has a slightly different recommendation than Iowa State and all these things. Though most of those recommendations are based off a paper from a single author in 1968, and he updated in 1972. And we just like use this equation forever to like say that we need 1.2 pounds of nitrogen per expected yield of bushel yield of corn per acre. So we just take these things and then, you know, that's been built into like umpteen models. It's like, if that's wrong, everything we know about fertilizer is wrong. And I think that's just, we have, you know, we're running into that with these complex systems. And then I think, you know, but it's also a fault of general science, more general, how it's sort of taken the spirituality and it's made the natural world very sterile. So we don't even imagine some of these concepts. And then it's funny to me how we think that like the burning of fossil fuels is, you know, potentially wreaked so much havoc on the world, or, you know, supposedly. But then like large scale obliteration of forests and tile drainage of 65 million acres, that hasn't done anything.
Right. So it's like, now those things are both extremely tightly correlated with fossil fuel use. So if you're looking at fossil fuel use, it would be like, yeah, that perfectly maps, right? Because it's so tightly correlated with tile drainage and deforestation, things like that, because you're burning fossil fuel to do those things. So it's like, you're looking at a variable and you're like, whoa, that variable really reliably goes with all these other things almost perfectly. The correlation's perfect here. But it's like, yeah, there's, you know, all there's these other things too. So it does kind of seem like there's support in that. I mean, if you are just looking at carbon, you can tell a story that maps somewhat closely to something that seems to be happening. But it's just like, yeah, the spreadsheet, myopic, you know, over-reliance on a single data point instead of contextualizing what carbon means in context. Like, yeah, it's not like, if I'm hearing it correctly, it's not unimportant. It just doesn't tell the whole story. It's sort of like a proxy for the whole story, but it's way, 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 way more complex than that.
Yeah. And then when we decide what's good for carbon or what, you know, oh, we did this and carbon changed and then we had great results like cover crops or silvopasture or any of these things, it may just be because you increased the soil, the water holding capacity of the soil. And, you know, you've brought this different function of, you've changed the way that water moves through that system too. And so, yeah, on both sides, you know, we don't give water enough credit. And the interesting thing about it too, is even if you're wrong, if we switch the whole narrative and decided to try to heal the water cycles around the world, we would fix the carbon problem anyhow, would too, right? Like these systems, we need more resilient living systems, perennial living systems on the land. And that would fix it no matter what the answer is. Or what the problem is.
Yeah. That seems to be, I agree. That seems to be the most helpful approach, because I think the issue with talking about climate change is it's still very abstract to a lot of people. And the models are very uncertain. And theoretically, you know, we can understand the greenhouse effect and putting a lot more energy in the atmosphere. But in terms of how we actually, you know, heal the planet, people can understand thriving living systems, right? Like that's very tangible and speaks to your soul to be in a place where the ecology seems to be working well. It's abundant, it's beautiful, it's productive. And that's not a very narrow calculation about carbon sequestration and how many carbon credits you're going to get for that. And, you know, which is, you know, that seems to be, you know, well-meaning progressive people are, you know, trying to boot up these carbon markets, you know, but again, you know, if that's not embedded within a much larger, more holistic picture, it's going to cause more harm than good. You're going to end up creating monocultures and, you know, very like narrow fixes that probably, for example, ruin the hydrological cycle, you know, or put it out even out of more whack, I'm guessing. Thoughts?
Go ahead. I just wanted to piggyback on that, because, you know, you were talking about, you know, that like, you know, looking at it scientifically or spreadsheet brain versus, you know, and I think aesthetically, and, you know, our favorite futurist sort of semi-troll Adam did a thread a while ago talking about the beauty of savannah, right? Like he's saying it's probably the most beautiful landscape in the world, which I would tend to agree with. Like it's inherently pleasing to the human eye to see, all this beautiful grassland dotted with trees. When and I think there's something important to that aesthetic, and when you just view it, it seems beautiful and correct. Also, coincidentally, what we're talking about is how ecologically incredible savannas are. I just think that there is something in the human eye that knows good things when it sees it.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't know what the source of it is. Either we know it's good or it's possible because humans built every savanna that's ever been and have been active managers since the beginning of time. So it's very homing to us. I heard a stat the other day, and I won't put numbers to it because I don't remember, but there's a smell when a that a field takes on, and especially in a savanna sense, but this is also true even like in tilled fields. There's a smell that comes out after a rain, and it's given off by a bacteria, I believe, but maybe a fungi in the soil. And it, like you could think it, from the Midwest, right? You know, when people start tilling soil, you get that smell, and you could smell that for miles. So the sensor in the human brain that senses that smell is something like 100 times more powerful than a great white shark can sense blood in the water. Humans are.
That's cool.
Nothing happens as an accident. And whether, you know, you believe it's a long arc of evolution or just divine power that was set in, that's not an accident. That's not something weird. That's because people, when they were more nomadic, this is likely because, like, when it rains in the savanna, that is the freaking place to be. And you may need to smell it from 50 miles away and start heading there. There's deep, deep connections to these lands. I just got shivers just even thinking about that. Yeah. Like, it's something there, right? Like, and I'm a totally different person in 9 years of managing this land. Just walking amongst the trees and stewarding them. And that's, you know, other self work underneath of lots of that. But it's a very nice place to be.
Let's talk a little bit about your day to day. Like, what is managing and building these landscapes look like in terms of, you know, just, you know, now I have to go rotate these animals, and then I have to go do some earthworks over here. And yeah, just give us a taste of, like, you know, what your day to day is like. I think that would be interesting.
Great. So the context is that my wife has a job. She works from home. But my primary duty is then like the homeschooling parent, and just childcare for one child, but one or 10, they take your devotion and attention. And so it's not necessarily a full time gig at this point. At times it has been, you know, you work hard and work long hours, but I'm just, you know, it's not 14 hours a day grinding out. Like it would have been, you know, if I had this farm as a childless or a bachelor or whatever. So we graze sheep. Currently, we don't have any beef cows. That's where we started. We've gone into sheep, and we're in the horizon, hopefully in 2025, going to take on a neighbor's lease and bring cows back in a big way to really increase our land base. So
you have do you know what breed you want to get? This is cow geek questions now.
Yeah. I don't know what I would do if I have the opportunity to really like bring on a whole herd. When we did it before, I had one or two house jerseys and I bred them back to Red Angus, and then had a couple of cows that I kept as like half Jersey, half Red Angus, and breed them back to Red Angus. And that is the most fabulous meat. And so depending on how I start up again, which I do want another. We don't have a jersey now, and we just had we were supposed to purchase one in September, and I think that deal just fell through. But I love Jersey Red Angus. That meat is just fabulous.
I think Jacob Wolke, who we interviewed here a while ago, I think he does dairy beef, I believe, if I'm remembering that right.
Yeah, so amazing. So I'm not sure. There's guys around here that are doing Galloways, and there's some guys that have like started. A guy I know that I delivered meat for a few years, Carcasses, he's got Galloways and now has brought in a few other breeds, and I may just go to him to start. It's interesting. There's a ton of big dairies around me too, and so it even could be where I would start to buy on some Jersey steers and just for the first few years building up my home flock based around home dairy.
Yeah.
And start to save some cows there, but it may just be interesting to buy in some Jersey steers. And I'm in love with that meat, and I don't think I'd have a problem selling it. I've got a good grazing mentor here too that raises Texas Longhorns, and he'd love for me to probably take on a herd of those too, but I don't know if I'll do that.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, sidebar. Well, I was just, you were talking about sheep and then expanding perhaps into cattle.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to hear your thoughts too, because I do know, like, I've just bought more haphazardly now, and my first jersey I brought in, she was really pampered in a dairy, and then neglected in her second life, and we were sort of the third life. But like, I think she would have starved to death in some of my pastures if I just left her there. She would have starved to death in like boot deep grass because she was just picky. Mm. And so I would want to get into making sure I had a herd that was more refined. Like, I want you short legs, and I want your face in the ground, and I want you eating.
Barrel on little stumpy stilts. That's
yes. Yeah. And it's like, not everyone is that. And I, you know, I think animal selection makes a big difference.
Within breed, there's a lot of variance too, you know, like as much as between breeds.
Yeah. And in general, like, and we also don't have, we did some fair to finish pigs for several years, and we backed off to just like buying in wieners for our own home use and to serve four or five close families. But it's like in our pig operation, like I was very much, and across the board, I think ultimately the long term is you want to have all your breeding moms to have been born on your farm. Mm-hmm. There's huge benefit in that. Like I've taken on sheep now, this is the fourth or fifth year, and we've got a few that we're culling out this year, and probably one or two more years before we're sort of all born here. I think that's huge. They just know the whole routine. I open paddocks. I have places where I run them 400 yards through the woods. They know where they go, and they just go. So that sort of selection is good. So, yeah. And then to add to the list, then we've got broiler chickens, several batches a year, or two to three, four batches a year, a small layer flock, and then some random other waterfowl running around. But so the daily work is the sheep move like in the spring as much as every 12 hours, like moving them sort of morning and night just to try to keep ahead of the forage. Now it's sort of slowed down. It's on the far end of that spectrum. And, you know, there may be moot. I have my ram flock, which is most of my meat animals, and my breeders, they're moving like every couple days. And currently my ewe flock is slowed down to about every big paddocks, but every 3 days. So, you know, there's usually a half hour or so of animal of like ruminant chores, to go with those. And that includes, you know, so I guess the question was posited as like a day in the life sort of thing. Like you're out checking your animals in the morning. I don't often move my animals right away in the morning because, there's a philosophy that like the two things that it's nice if the dew dries off of the grass before you move them, so they're not ingesting all that water, to fill them up. And then also, the sugars really kick in the plants in the like sort of noon and afternoon. So
the brick score is highest, right?
Yes. Yep. So ideally, if I can move my animals in the afternoon, that's what I'll do. Also, since none of my pastures are like super ideal, making them set there that next morning and forcing them to eat like some of the plain grass, they've already sort of, you know, nibbled down the clovers and stuff. It's forcing them to eat a little more of that stuff, of the less valuable stuff before they move in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. Is a good way. So we've got that check. I move my meat chickens once a day. And, you know, those chores just take maybe a half hour, 45 minutes to spend, depending on what, you know, fixing a water or that sort of thing. And then, you know, it's seasonal, which I really like about being in the sort of temperate climates, right? Like we make use of like the whole long day in the summer. Although I'm not the type to like get up there and be grinding away super early. It's nice, you know, to sit and relax and watch the sunrise and stuff. You don't need to be like digging a hole at 6:30 in the morning typically. But maybe digging a hole at 9:30 at night, cause I like to get out there and just sort of make the most of the day. But then in the winter, it's much slower. Animals are parked. You know, we have some stockpiled grass, but it's all close to the house. And so there's maybe four or five paddocks that they're in and I'm delivering hay to in those paddocks. And it's much more relaxed. You know, there's maybe 45 minutes of total chores in the day. And I start with animals because really that's one thing I've learned. And it may be a reason that you wouldn't want animals as a new farmer. And this is like Mark Shepherd has said this, certainly in person, but probably in like some recorded sessions, is like, once you have animals, man, they're their priority. And so you can have all the plans in the world for how many plants you're going to, or how many trees you're going to plant that day, or if you're going to till the garden. But like, if your animals and your toddler Don't agree. There is no way around that, right? Like, those are the two you get to triage.
If they're out of the fence, they're out of the fence.
They're out of the fence, or just even, yeah. Fixing chicken tractors or doing whatever you might have to do, checking waters. Like, yeah. I just, you know.
Yeah, they don't, if animals priority. Don't have water, they just, like, literally die.
Yes, exactly. So there's, you know, you gotta do those. But then we've tried to have like a good session of a week or two each year where we can really take on like an earthworks type project. And we didn't do anything like that our first year here, because I did try to follow the permaculture principle of like just sit and watch for a while. Like, I didn't feel like I could be digging, you know, can't show up. I'm not really familiar with this area. I can't show up in May and start digging around and then realize that winter is not what I expected. And even some of the things I did in the first couple of years, you know, I would do differently now. But so each year we've sort of taken on different things, terracing and ponding. And, you know, one year we took, my wife took 2 weeks of vacation, and we like completely terraformed the backyard with a 8-ton excavator and just like built a plunge pool and all of our gardens and a big berm. And so we try to get those projects in every year. You know, there's usually a good week or two, one in the summer or one in the spring and one in the fall, where I do try to dedicate to tree planting or more than that. That's like second tier thing. You get, once you get a bunch of tree seedlings, you know, delivered or picked up, as soon as you get animal chores done, you got to start dealing with those trees, and everything else goes by the byway until the bare root trees are planted. And then, you know, I'm trying to figure out how other things go into the flow for the season. Like, one thing that's really on my mind now and lately is tree hay. And so, like, trying to figure out how to get out there and drop trees and dry trees and just these other little tasks that sort of come up, which just, yeah, all trying to figure it out, right? It's all sort of like throw spaghetti at the wall. Some things I'll dedicate a lot of time to, and then I'll never do that ever again.
And so, and how do you envision, or how do you hope or dream that the system will develop in, say, the next 1, 2, 3 decades? Like, what is the ideal kind of trajectory until you feel like you're in kind of like this, you know, it's always evolving, but you're at a point where it's like, okay, this is a mature system that now we're just kind of maintaining or something. Like, what is that trajectory for you?
Yeah, definitely changes, right? Like, cause I'll run out of earthworks. Got a bunch more ponds to build, but nothing that really makes a big change in the pattern on the landscape.
I guess growing is a big one, is an obvious one. Like, okay, this chestnut is going to take 10 years to get to some kind of maturity or something.
Yeah. And so that's what it is. It's like, we have lots of chestnuts and hazelnuts planted, oaks. You know, I guess I'll take a step back and say there's maybe like 4 categories of trees that we have planted or are utilizing from wild stock, which is like firewood, and then fodder to feed the animals, and then like fruit and nuts.
Firewood and fodder trees.
Oaks to some extent with respect to some firewood, just because they're planted pretty densely and I think they'll need to be thinned. And I'd also like to experiment some on like people do like this in Japan. There's a 15-year oak coppice where you can coppice the oak every 15 years for mushroom logs and firewood. But I don't plan on cutting tons of oaks in my lifetime, really. Largely black locust in that respect. I'd love to do the calculations to see what it would take to make like a, I've got an outdoor wood furnace and love to, I need to sit down. We keep adding things, so I need more wood every year, because we now run 2 houses off of that place. But I'd like to figure out like the BTUs it would take to have a no split black locust firewood system, and then just plant as much as that as I need. And there, that would be a 15-year like coppice rotation, where after you cut a tree in 15 years, it shoots up a whole bunch of sprouts from the base. And then you trim that off, you prune those in the first couple of years. So there's only 4 shoots would come off of that. And then essentially you can have just no split firewood for the rest of your life. You know, once you're sort of 30 or 45 years into that cycle. So I won't live 45 years likely, but Well, no, I guess 45 is right about where I might I might get to. So those are basically the firewood tree that I have sort of in place now. There's other things, like I've planted lots of shagbark hickories, but those things are so like slow growing. They're not really sort of in a firewood coppice. We're also clearing out all the ash have died here. So I have good numbers of ash to still burn. And then all the beech are starting to die and they need quite a lot of thinning. So I'm not really pressed for firewood with my 20 acre woodlot and with the neighbors. But it's something I'd like to think about. And then black locust just makes the most sense. Like we've already mentioned, it's super fast growing. It's the highest BTU wood, like in North America, basically, or, you know, one of the top two. Fodder trees, black locust also, although I find they don't really eat a whole lot of that. Quite a lot of mulberries, some fast growing poplar, willows. And I've got some willows that are like planted in hedge lines, but then also just some wet spots that naturally get willows, then those get lots of willow and like the quaking aspen, so I cut a lot of those for fodder. But then also I think like the oaks are would be a great fodder plant if it was in sort of a firewood or a mushroom log type of rotation. So yeah, that's about it, I think, for my...
And fruit and nuts. So I guess some nuts you think about in terms of fodder, and some nuts you think about in terms of your own consumption. And fruit, and same thing with fruit. So like what fruit and nuts are you really excited about?
Yeah, so I think in answering the main part of the question too, I wanted to say, like, I feel like industrial ag really serves two things nicely, like oil and protein. And so... as much as we can help to produce those things, then these systems have a better chance of displacing industrial agriculture. So I think the nuts are going to be very important for oil. There's some people around here experimenting with like oil pressing, and then we can utilize even lots of the native nuts. Like around here, you could probably, if you could collect enough, like bitternut hickories make great oils after you press them. There's no bitterness to them. So I think we need nuts for those, for that sort of, to replace seed oils. And I don't know, but yeah, we've come to vilify those more and more in our house too, as sort of zeitgeist shifted on seed oil. So I think it's important those. And then like the other side of that is like, we've got hazelnuts, quite a lot of hazelnuts. And like, I think that will eventually be a big part of my alternative chicken feed ration. Like I'd love to just be grinding hazelnuts in a mix mill and feeding those to chickens. And so some of it is like, how can we, access, like the chestnuts very well could be like a wholesale market of oil, or, you know, a scaled market of oil, especially where if there could be mobile presses that were shared around the community. But then some of the pieces like the hazelnuts, I think will probably be more, I haven't planted like the really production varieties. And so just grinding them for chickens, is probably going to be a better, like a long-term plan. And then, yeah, fruits. I've got just a little bit of everything planted. We're in a really nice zone here. It's like zone 6 in the USDA scale. Like everything grows. So I get some decent peaches. I haven't had a great peach crop yet, but like around here, people grow nice peaches. And then apples. I've just got a whole whack. Basically all the different heirloom varieties that the seed catalog had, I tried, or the nursery here had, like I've got planted in a swale, like my first orchard here that I planted in 2016. You know, just has like 5 or 10 different varieties of heritage apples. Although I think like long-term, I've started now planting more pear. I think they're a more resilient crop here. And like, ultimately I see apples and pears and that sort of thing being like obviously food for us, but then like a nice food that then the fallen fruits can go to livestock, pigs, but then also cider. And so pears make, if the pear is a more resilient fruit and I like to eat them and they make cider just as good or better, like at least mixed in with the apples is nice. That's sort of what we're growing here. So one thing, when I think about the long-term trajectory of the farm, I sort of have like a sort of different scales of what I think could happen. And like, I do come to all of this from like quite a doomer foundation. And so, like, I think there's a chance that lots of land could go fallow for a while and maybe be found again And so I want something here that's going to, you know, if I die tomorrow, or if just sort of ag as we know it sort of stops tomorrow, if somebody finds this place in 100 years, I want them to like feel like they found the Garden of Eden. And, you know, it might behoove humanity to have lots of these places scattered around the world such that there are systems that could be left alone for these 3 to 5 decades, but then people could come and like there wouldn't be sheep grazing here, but there would be a hell of a lot of deer and turkeys and fruit and clean water and tap springs. And so like I want to put that pattern on the landscape. And sort of then the highest level of that is I came across a concept a few years ago that really spoke to me of the Oak Sentinel system. And so essentially like you can't really go more than 200 yards here without me having a big bur oak or a white oak planted. Some places a lot more dense than that, just with the thought that like those could possibly be the ones that would reforest the whole area afterwards. Like they're not in the greatest places, and maybe even some of them when things are really thriving I'll cut down, but for now they're like the, you know, if it whatever, if I can't do this work tomorrow, there's a chance that some of these oaks could reforest the whole area, right? And that was an important part, that long arc. I want this place to be useful for people in 200 years, even if they're not my kin.
Isn't that isn't that what we use the term prefiguration about?
Prefiguration. Yeah, ecological prefiguration. You set the patterns on the landscape, and then maybe that will help to organize a society that can work with those patterns in a useful way.
Interesting. I like that even more. So they're not even just going to come here and eat, but they may be inspired to different pattern thinking that is.
Exactly. Well, they might live. See how you know, use, like, if they're able to recognize kind of the brilliance of the system that's in place that, you know, some human steward had left behind, you know, ideally they would think about how do we organize our society to preserve this, to even improve it, to maintain this abundance. That would be a nice dream. Instead of coming across just like, you know, you come into Iowa and it's just a bunch of like desolated kind of desertified former cornfields, you're probably going to be thinking about your society very differently. Maybe much more, I don't know, centralized and authoritarian. Who knows?
Yeah. But you even see that play out in real time. I do some conservation volunteer work and we run into all sorts of people, but like there are people that hate black locusts, and I mean, I don't necessarily like buckthorn and stuff, but they say things like, I bought this field 20 years ago and now look at it. It's just like degraded, nothing, full of black locusts. You can't get it in, you know, and then so they do nothing for 20 years, and then maybe they finally get pissed off enough. They rent, like, get an excavator with a chopper in there to like brush hog it all out. It's like, well, it's because you didn't do anything. You didn't do anything yourself to establish a pattern. You didn't engage any animal allies. Like, there's, you know, like black locust can be a problem, and I manage it well here, and I try to do things like root prune it and stuff so it doesn't go out into the fields. But it's like I could leave here now. I don't really think that would be a problem. Like it might form a nice basis of the forest, but it's not going to take over because there's already a pattern in place. Like in ecology, it's the idea of alternative stable states, right? And the ecosystem can be in a stable state and then it can get shifted out and it's in this precarious place, but then it's going to fall back into another stable state. And so like, it's sort of a stable state agriculture happening here. And, sort of conventional industrial agriculture is always just like whipping it out of that state, and then it's like, well, let it fall where it may, but you don't have to let it fall. You can guide it to a certain spot,
as Jason alluded to, right? Like in what you're saying, you take these cornfields around where I live, right, and give them 100 years, I mean they're just a mess.
Oh, terrible.
I mean, and they'll settle into something, but it won't be usable for us.
No, and even like here, I'm sure that I have legacy ag tile that's like stealing water from my well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, occasionally I'll do something and suddenly like I just have a geyser will shoot up in the middle of the pasture where I finally like a tile's collapsed. And like, I mean, that's a whole nother topic too. That tile is going to be Pandora's box that future generations will curse us for the amount of subsurface drainage tile that we have in the Midwest and the earth. I mean, it's the same around here. And they just keep putting it in. They will curse us for that. And so Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about chestnut trees? We kind of mentioned in passing when you were talking about what nut trees to grow, but I mean, we all have a lot of nostalgia about the, you know, thinking about the American chestnut that, you know, was a huge part of, at least, I don't know, I'm in the Southeast United States in the Appalachians. And so, you know, that has a lot of mythical power here, just how ubiquitous it was and, you know, like how much it sustains animal and human populations. What's the argument for planting a bunch of, say, hybrids or Chinese chestnut, or, you know, what are the promises of chestnut? Can they be an oil crop? Are they a good, I know they're kind of more carb based instead of protein based. What do you all think about chestnuts and planting a bunch of them, and what's the idea behind that? And I asked selfishly because I've planted a bunch of chestnuts and I'm thinking of planting a bunch more. And so I'm just kind of wondering.
I think chestnuts are awesome. That's my answer.
Yeah, but why? What are the tree crops? What are the uses?
But you could pretty readily eat them, you know, right away, which I think is like the availability is a nice thing about them, right? Like you can steam them or roast them and they break open and you can eat them. Whereas like something like an oak that needs a lot of, you know, preparation to sort of get through the tannins and that sort of like creating oak acorn flour. Like you can make yourself sick just sitting there eating oaks, but I don't think you can really do that with chestnuts. You can eat them raw, but you can very quickly process them when they get past that point. So I think there's a lot of like accessibility there, but I think it is a nice, like a way to displace sort of, like you said, that carb or starch fraction of the industrial diet, like a lot of productivity per acre. And whether that ends up going into like an industrial processing stream or is just fed right to pigs, you know, I would think it's probably better to feed it right to animals, but I think there's a lot of potential there. No, I think chestnuts is one of those ones that it's like, can we have like this intuitive tie to it? I heard an account once on a podcast where they were making the point, and I don't know, it was kind of convincing to me that, you know, chestnuts may have actually been manna, just the way it was described, of falling from the trees at night and had to be picked up early in the morning before the rodents sort of woke and gathered it. And I think there's this, you know, it's a tough, resilient tree. Lots of other uses too, like the wood from chestnuts. And I also just like on the idea of chestnuts is I'm definitely not the friend of restorationists and such, who want to keep things to just like just planting, you know, varieties that they're trying to select for American chestnuts. Like I do have a lot of those planted, but I'm also very much the fan of planting hybrids and, Chinese chestnuts. I have a friend whose grandfather started a farm. He's not far away from me here. And either his grandfather or his dad, a long time ago, donated like an acre or two to the Ontario Chestnut Council. And there's this big, beautiful chestnut planting, and lots of them had died from blight and stuff. And it's, they'd still do selected crosses in there. And like, we go to that grove every year and pick chestnuts to eat. But what do? We walk past like 500 American chestnuts, and we pick from this big, beautiful Chinese chestnut that just has these big, beautiful nuts and is growing just great there. And to me, I don't think Mother Nature, especially in service of healing at a time when we're highly destructive and are creating novel ecosystems, I don't think Mother Nature cares if it's a Chinese chestnut or a American. And if we want to like preserve that American history I think there's benefits for preserving the genetics, but just plant them side by side. It's not about only plant American or you're, you know, completely outcast, which is sort of the way some of it is. I get some free chestnuts from the Ontario Chestnut Council, and I basically have to tell them that I don't have any other chestnuts here because I got all sorts of Mark Shepherd chestnuts planted around. And they're like, oh, you know, it's breeding stock. We want to be able to come back in 100 years and know we have pure chestnuts. Well, that ain't happening here.
Yeah, it reminds me of like, you know, kind of, it's I think this idea sometimes that, you know, you go back to this pre, you know, you go back to the way things were before. We just need to go back to how they were before. Like somehow we can turn back. And you see that in a cultural context as well, like the return with the V idea that we need to return to a certain point. We need to return ecologically to a certain point. And I mean, we're people, we're humans, you know, we're always changing. We're always modifying our environment. We just have to sort of accept that and move forward and recognize that whatever comes next is going to be a synthesis of everything that's come before. It's not going to be a return to something. It's not going to be kind of, you know, hearkening back to a time when we had it right. You know, we're synthesizing all the tools we have, and that's what it's going to be.
To me, that's the difference between the word restoration and the word regeneration.
Mm-hmm.
Regeneration is implying ecosystems are always evolving and changing, and it won't be the same, but it'll be more abundant and healthier, versus restoration implies to me more you're trying to go back somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and if we bring in the idea of resilience too, we better be more interested in regeneration, because there's nothing that says that restored ecosystems are resilient to novel future scenarios.
Right.
Probably less so. A lot of times, yeah, you have to guard them so carefully, you know, instead of...
Well, the cat's out of the bag. We have so many foreign, quote unquote, foreign species of plants, especially that, I mean, you're not going to take them all out and destroy them. They're here to stay.
Yeah. And we also don't, we look at these, we look back nostalgically on these things like the oak savanna of North America pre-settlement, but it's if we're not acknowledging the human management that was already going on there,
yeah,
then we're never going to be able to recreate an oak savanna if we don't believe in fire or people on the land, you know, sort of the folly of the sort of like land sparing ideas. I mean, there's good reason to believe like that the Amazon forest is 100 completely like 100% man-made manipulated. Like the odds of probabilities that the five most common and biggest trees are all like these beautiful nut varieties, like everything of the top popular trees in the Amazon is like has a great human use, and it suggests that we've been cultivating it, right? But even in today's age, we still look at the Amazon as like this pristine untouched place, and they even want to kick people out. It's like, no, it's completely built by humans in synergy with nature, right? Like, not saying that squirrels weren't planting nuts, but that was like a highly managed system for a long time. And so if we don't recognize that, we can't build it.
Yeah. Well, we need to wrap up soon. We're hitting almost the 90-minute mark. But I want to give both of you a chance to kind of give some last thoughts, you know, tie things together. Anything you think we missed? And Nate, you want to go first?
Sure. I mean, you know, I could just, this is a great conversation. You know, it ties so many, I think the thing for me that stands out is it, you know, just provides this bigger context for, I think it's really important. I think we're really hung up, and it's why I dug in a little more with the carbon myopia. You know, 'cause it isn't that that's not important. It's not that we're not in ecological trouble. We are. It's just the way that we think about it doesn't suggest any solutions that are actually going to be solutions. And so I think, you know, being able to kind of step back from that, and I think there's so much anxiety or pressure on that thing that it precludes people from looking more broadly. And if you take a step back and literally look with your eyes and be in contact, you know, with the place and feel, well, what if this place worked ecologically? And then if you scale that up, well, what if every place worked ecologically? Rather than, hey, we need to find this top-down thing that's going to pull carbon out. You know, we can build some cool things that are going to pull carbon out of the atmosphere and everything will be great. It's like, well, no, like, let's remember what, you know, a healthy ecology looks like that can support people in a landscape and scale that. And so, and I think that, you know, when you talk about silvopasture, it's a combination. It's that diversity. It's, to me, it's the image of the savanna, and you've got, we didn't talk much about grass, you know, but like, because we talk about trees, but then it's the grass in between the trees. That's actually what I'm most in love with. I'm infatuated with grasses right now in grassland. And the way that the tree roots, you know, like you go beneath the soil, you got these huge, giant, massive tree roots, but then you have like a thick, enormous carpet of soil and grass roots that's, you know, 6, 7, 8 feet deep, just huge. And all this is a living thing, and all this is holding soil in place. And so you have these healthy ecosystems, and then you scale that and scale that and scale that, right? And that's how you heal the earth, you know, not you're not by focusing on a single element and thinking that's the whole thing. So that's the part of the conversation I appreciate the most. Although this is just really, really great. Enjoying this a whole lot.
Great.
Awesome. Yeah. Let's see, to wrap it up, you know, I think I've oscillated between the doomer and the optimist quite a lot, and I find myself to be an optimist now. And I think a lot of it is just being immersed in this place where I've been able to be in the last 8-9 years. And so, like, I just, it's a, yeah, it's just, I'm trying to think of how to say this. A bit of, I can feel how right it is to be creating like these sorts of places, and just to, like, build on what, you know, Nate was saying. It's like, yeah, we just need to do these things. And I don't think that I'm necessarily doing anything right. And I'm sure a grazer could come in and totally critique everything I'm doing wrong. And a arborist could come in and totally critique everything I'm doing wrong. But, you know, I think it's a really interesting time, and like, we're privileged in many ways to just be able to be here and experimenting with novel ecosystems. And I think we are moving into sort of a future that there's a lot of possible futures out there, and some of them are quite doomer, but you know, we can nudge it towards the optimistic way. And you know, the way to do it is to heal the land, and because it becomes a synergy of you know, healing the land heals the people. There's lots of examples of this. You know, there's one of my sort of friends and mentors in the water realm is Zach Weiss, and he tells a story of in India, Rajendra Singh. You know, they're healing rivers, and it's like these like communities are just coming back to life, both because they have productive agriculture, but just because it's a habitat worth living, and like, just like building viable human habitats and healing the earth in that way is like such an important part of what we need to do at this time. And it's like, yeah, I just feel grateful to be at a time when we can do it. Like, it's such a great time to be a small farmer. Like, there's access to tree stock and nursery stock like there's never has been before. We're trading and buying and selling and trading animals on social medias and learning from people. And, you know, there's 7 million small tools. I'm about to go out and buy a DeWalt 1.5-inch electric pruner for cutting some fodder and stuff. Like, there's just, it's such a cool time to be able to do these things on the land. And so just, and that's exactly what we need to do. I don't think anybody needs to do it right. We just need to do it. You know, I had a post the other day, and I think it speaks to the novel ecosystems. Actually, one line I was going to put in when Nate was first speaking there too, is just, there's like a Taoist saying that you never step in the same river twice. That's because it's always flowing by. So even if you return a week later, it's not the same river, right? Like, things have shifted. That's certainly not that water, which is way down, and time is the same way. So we're in this time of creating novel ecosystems. It's so important. And you know, that happens differently for everyone. It can be their backyard, it can be a garden, it can be their house plants, like, start to reforge these connections. And then that just brought me to the closing thought, which from the other day I said on online, is just like, you know, we don't need people that are worrying about like making the future better. Just make now better, and the future will take care of itself. It's like,
yeah
don't even worry about the future, just do it. Like, and I know, you know, I know my now is better than my previous now. And so, nice. Which is part of why I am optimistic, because I know that people can change. I know that land can change. I know that like healing is there. And I know that we have all sorts of allies, earthly and spiritually, and embedded in the land and the earth, like everything and everyone is cheering for us. Mm-hmm. So now we just have to do it.
Can I add real quick, Jason, before you wrap it up? I just want to say on a more personal note, you know, that sometimes like my farm's pretty big and it's a lot, and sometimes I have been sort of struggling at times last year with burnout and feeling frustrated and whatnot, and just this conversation is invigorating and very inspiring to me. So I appreciate that and just wanted to add in that, like, it really helps remind me and touch into the excitement and the inspiration. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Beautiful. Well, I don't think I can add to either what you said. I thought both of you said was inspiring and beautiful. I could just note for myself that I understand all the reasons to be a doomer. I've studied them intensely. But working with some land, being a land steward on a very small scale, I'm on 5 acres, it's impossible for me to be a doomer, because what I see is I see life and I see. I see beauty and and I see, a future. I see a future. And I just think that if you're inspired by this conversation for the audience, we're going to need many more land stewards. Like, many more people are going to have to engage with nature again if we're going to make it. But it's not this like ordeal, it's not like this step down in quality of living. It's actually what can make you optimistic if you're a big doomer, and that optimism at that local scale by seeing it, if spread around at a broad scale with enough people, will actually create, the optimistic future, I think. So just wanted to add that at the end there. Thank you guys, this is great. Until next time, take care.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Yep, thank you.